all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. All things move toward their end. On that, you can be sure. For almost two decades, Facebook has dominated headlines and the lives of its users. It's been blamed for genocides, pointed to as a vector of disinformation, and depressed you as you scrolled past high school acquaintances that seemed to be doing so much better than you. But now, its founder Mark Zuckerberg is obsessed with a virtual world no one wants. The company's stock is down 70% of its peak. It's lost $800 billion of its market capitalization. And his business model is starting to feel under siege. Are we finally witnessing the end of Facebook? With us here on Cyber today to answer that question is Motherboard staff writer Edward Anguiso Jr. It's the subject of his new piece, Facebook's Monopoly is Imploding Before Our Eyes. Stick around. We might just talk about Twitter, too, at the end of this. Edward, how are you doing today?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on.
So let's cut to the chase. Is Facebook over?
I think, you know, Facebook is going to be around for a while simply because of how much money it has and is and flows through it. You know, a lot of this panic was set off by a small decrease in advertiser revenue, but this is significant because advertiser revenue has not consistently decreased, and it did over the past few quarters. In the midst of it posting large losses from investing and committing to the metaverse pivot through Reality Labs subdivision, right? So it's less that Facebook is over than this is an opportunity to look at how as powerful Facebook might feel. It also is a lot more fragile, or has become a lot more fragile in the last few years, surprisingly, in a few key areas because of missteps, miscalculations, regulatory scrutiny, public backlash, and delusions of grandeur from some of the executives.
Right. This has always kind of been my thing, like not to mitigate the very real bad stuff that Facebook has done. But there, I think that in the moment when we're discussing these things, there's this tendency to view these companies as these totalizing forces in our life that are never going away. Right. The truth is, like, on a long enough timeline, like, things will weaken and fade. And I think the shock here is that it happened to Facebook so fast, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's entirely right. You know, Facebook is a company that has about 2 billion users, you know, almost 200 million in the U.S. It's constantly growing like 2-3% every quarter. It has its tentacles in so many walks of life, right? It has all these marketplaces. It has communication platforms. It has other social networks. It has a virtual reality. It has attempts to get into e-commerce and so on and so forth, that it feels like a staple and an institution, maybe in people's daily lives. But I think that's also because of how much it's tried to insert itself into the landscape of the digital world, which then is where some of the weaknesses can emerge, because it's, you know, its strength is premised on people using it in digital, you know, in digital space a certain way, and the economics of that place staying the same more or less.
Right. Can you kind of lay out how Facebook became a juggernaut? Because it wasn't necessarily that everyone was sharing photos of like what they did on the weekend, right? That was part of it, but that's not how they really made money.
Yeah. I mean, it's an advertising platform, right? I mean, First and foremost, Facebook is a platform to sell ads, right? And becomes more and more increasingly lucrative as one, thanks to how many people are on it and the things that they do on it. And Facebook has tried to make sure that people do more things on it or do more types of certain things on it, whether that's, you know, its attempt to introduce shopping on Instagram, dating on Facebook, create message forums, create groups, create marketplaces. You know, all of these things are attempts to get people on there, of course, and ostensibly to connect the world. But really, it's an advertising platform. And that has been the core revenue model for Facebook as long as it has existed. It has posted massive you know, amounts of money from that. And that's where a lot of its success has come from.
So, you know, the metaverse and how just the disaster that it has been so thus far gets a lot of press right now, but it's not the thing that's eating away necessarily at Facebook's core business model, right? It's not the thing that's attacking the advertising. You write in your piece about what's going on at Apple. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Apple was able to introduce some privacy changes that restricted basically how much information was users of its devices would be giving up in an iOS 14 update. And some of these privacy changes basically result in undermining your value as, you know, an eyeball for advertisers, essentially. The accuracy of some of the ads, and the rationale for putting an ad in a certain place, right? So that's undermined and cost Facebook, I think they estimate $10 billion from their advertiser operation. And there's also been, as a result of that, there have been, you know, cascading effects where advertisers also had hard times placing ads in Facebook's other products, right? So in Instagram, of course, and Facebook itself, but also in Reels, which is the Instagram TikTok clone that has been, you know, that the company has attempted to roll out to disrupt and push out TikTok unsuccessfully, though.
And what about the cut that Apple takes? It's changing to 30%, or it is, or what's the deal there?
Yeah. So that's also going to be a big one. You know, there have been battles over the past few years, I would say, but more recently, the last year or two, over app stores and how much the provider of a platform's app store is able to take from each sale. Apple has been, you know, walking around with a baseball bat demanding 30% from everybody for a while now, and has been largely successful in getting it, fighting court battles to ensure that they get it, or at least that compromises are in their favor. And now in pushing, you know, Facebook, or complicating the picture of Facebook applications, the Facebook services being on the App Store, because now, you know, you have to pay this huge commission fee, and then Facebook has to figure out how to recoup that or how to incorporate that. Do you hike the fees? Who do you hike the fees on? Who are you passing off that cost to, right? Because Facebook's not going to eat that. No company wants to eat a commission cost. They usually just pass it on to someone. So it's these things, increases in costs, less information coming in for advertisers, and slowing growth also in user adoption have been some of the things that have compounded to starting to see advertiser revenue decline for the first few times.
Right. And it kind of points to, it's interesting because it points to Apple being more of a traditional monopoly, right? They're the real monopoly.
I mean, here, like, they control the access to their marketplace, right? I mean, Apple has spent a long time creating this little, you know,
the walled garden,
to try to ensure that you got to pay a certain fee to come in, because they have access to these billions of users who are using their phones and devices and other platforms that are exclusive to Apple and the iOS systems. And it works to an extent, right? That's a good way to leverage market power into forcing other companies to comply with your demands. And so, you know, that's the sort of stuff we would expect to see from a monopoly, not just leveraging profits in one division to take control of another, but also being able to set the terms of competition in various sectors and preventing other people from, or threatening to prevent other people from entering them if they don't play by the rules.
And it's not like Facebook can just opt out, right? Because iPhone is other people have Android, of course, and there's other systems, but iPhone is the mobile market, right?
Yeah.
If you're not playing there, you're walking away from billions of dollars. So you have to do what they say, and there's not a lot you can do about it.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, it would be ridiculous, I think, from the company's perspective to walk away from Apple. So you just have to figure out you know, one, what to do in the meantime and who to eat the, you know, who to make eat the cost. Then two, like, are there any lobbying or legal strategies that we can use to try to undermine this? Can we get consumers to fight against it? Can we convince them that it's actually bad for them? Can we convince lawmakers that it's bad? Can we convince industry folks that it's bad? You know, like, what are the ways we can undermine this while we suffer it in the meantime?
Yeah, and one of the kind of the fascinating end runs that Facebook tried to do, you talk about in the piece, and I completely forgotten about it. So there's so many like weird little blips along the way of different things that they've tried. What was Libra?
Yeah, Libra was a. It's funny because I think it's fair to forget about it because I know a lot of people also, you know, have, and I think also at the time I did forget how ridiculous some of the discussion around it was. But basically Libra was an attempt to say, hey, we're going to create a digital currency, a cryptocurrency backed by a basket of sovereign currencies, and you know, this is going to allow people to use our currency in our communication system as a way to pay other people across the world immediately and transfer it out into those other currencies. So you know, they basically were proposing a way to, technically, if they wanted to, they claimed they didn't want to, but a way to compete with other currencies. So understandably, everyone said, no, you can't do that. When you can't make your own currency. You can't undermine our ability to, you know, control our own currencies. In theory, that the fears that Libra would be able to do that in one way or another. And so it was killed ceremoniously or stalled, right? So Libra was pitched, and so was a cryptocurrency wallet. Zuckerberg went in front of Congress. They said, what the hell are you doing? He said, okay, we'll pause it and we'll only do a US only version. Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell also killed that.
And he said it would strengthen the dollar, right?
Yeah, right. Which is, it was in the midst of saber rattling about China, right? So like they were pitching Libra not just as like, oh, this is a currency that we're gonna have, but you know, One of the arguments was that China has a really expansive communications network and a really integrated payment system, and they are advanced enough in implementation and deployment of it that they can not only scale it out throughout the country, but also bring it to other countries. And we have nothing on par with that except Facebook, and that's it, right? We don't have an international payments processor integrated into the communication network like that. So let us do it, because then we'll be more able to compete with China in markets that are in Asia or in Africa or in Europe or in other regions that the company is trying to, you know, get an upper hand in. So you do that and, you know, well, it's for national security. We'll all be better off.
I love the balls of walking up to the federal government and just ask, telling it like, hey, give up the seat of your power.
Yeah. A little batshit. It was ridiculous. You know, the peak of hubris to think that anyone in D.C. would say yes to it. But that's also a testament to like just how much power was coursing through Facebook and how delusional these people were. I mean, like people were talking about Zuck running for president. You remember that for years and years?
Well, and he was doing that. He was doing that thing where I can't remember what he called it, but he was doing the campaign where he was like going out and talking to normal people. And it almost,
he was wearing suits and shit.
It was like, he's thinking about it. He's like,
yeah, you know, and now I couldn't even imagine him running for like mayor or something, you know, like even a mayor that he runs, a town that he runs or something. Because I think that over the time, you know, the Libra, kind of clarified some things, or I hope it clarified things for people, which is that this is a company that, you know, the reason why it wanted Libra to happen is because it needed something other than advertising, and finance is a great idea. Finance and communications combinations have been incredibly profitable for the Chinese companies that have done them, and are the basis for super apps. They're the basis for incredibly profitable enterprises. They're integrated into gig economy apps. They're integrated into basic everyday apps for whether it's delivery, whether it's healthcare provision, you know, whether it's logistics, whether it's staffing. Like there's all sorts of ways in which if you merge a communications and a finance service, you can make and print money as a company. And Facebook needs something like that other than advertising, because the advertising situation we have, the little bubble we have, is not going to last, right?
Yeah. Well, it's. Let me ask you this then. Let's talk about ads on Facebook. When was the last time you were on Facebook?
When was the last time I was on Facebook? I think the last time I was on the blue Facebook, probably February, I think.
And how did you, what was your experience of it? And how did you find the ads?
incoherent. I think I was already confused with updates from people I hadn't seen in a while. And then the ads had nothing to do with me. I got ads for, I got diaper ads. I got a lot of weed ads. I don't smoke any weed. I got a lot of gardening, slightly relevant. What else did I get? A lot of car ads. I don't drive. Don't know how to drive either. So
it's funny. I have like one group chat that will not fucking leave. I've begged, I've tried, and they won't go. So it's the only thing I check in there. I like pull it up to just see what's going on in that group chat. And then you inevitably scroll for like 30 seconds because I've got a sick mind. And yeah, the only way I can feel like I can describe it is it's like if Tim and Eric were making, I'm an insomniac. So for a lot of my life, I've spent a lot of time like watching broadcast television after 2 a.m., which is when it you're not watching TV anymore. It's just infomercials and ads. And it's like if Tim and Eric were putting that kind of thing together and putting it on online. It's real weird stuff. And because
now
of
that, you say that, it kind of reminds me of the Tim Heidecker murder trial, if you've ever seen that.
Yeah. what a bizarre bit of performance art is Tim Heidecker in general, but that's a different podcast.
right.
Yeah. And because I get, because I write a lot of stuff about like defense, and weapons, I get some real dark, weird things that get served up to me. But let's back up just a minute. I want to talk about in the conversation, you were talking about super apps. And it's interesting that that's the phrase you use because when you look at Facebook outside of America, and especially WhatsApp, which it owns, so it's important to remember that Facebook is not just like Facebook in the metaverse. It is also WhatsApp, Instagram, some other companies I'm probably forgetting right now. But WhatsApp is the big one. And outside of America and other parts of the world, Facebook is already kind of a super app, right?
Yeah, I would say so. Because I think, Facebook has been able to convince some governments over time or pilot programs where it offers the core bit of services it has as Facebook basics, right? As, come in, let us offer internet connectivity. Let us offer communication with your family. It has, and Facebook's free basics is really interesting because it has come and gone, so many times, right? It was like kicked out of India, if I remember correctly, in 2016. And then kept expanding silently in Africa over the next few years. And has been, attempted to be heralded or do partnerships with civic society groups as like a way to increase literacy or a way to increase access to microloans or a way to, increase, data connectivity so we can get more granular data about yield, farm yields or water health, but again, what is it really just about? It's really, trying to figure out another way to expand, experiment with the advertising giant and see if there's another avenue for revenue, right? Because that is really once you understand Facebook's need for and understanding that it has to get something outside of advertising revenue, a lot of its moves start to make a lot more sense, right? It understands the advertising bubble allowed it to get to billions and billions of users, but once the bubble bursts, if it doesn't have a real way to continue to generate, you know, revenue, it's not going to be able to offer these services for free, and it's going to have to figure out another revenue stream. Maybe that's commodifying data. Maybe that's in a more outright way, or maybe that's just offering a new service that's integral to everybody's life, but it has to find out a new one.
All right, cyber listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. If you are watching the live stream, there will be no ads. If you are listening to the podcast, though, here is a word from our sponsor.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, cyber listeners, welcome back. We are talking with Edward Anguiso Jr. about the end, question mark, of Facebook, or maybe the metamorphosis it's going through as it kind of falls off the FANG label and becomes just another tech company. Have you ever used Facebook Basic?
No, I have family that has used it. And some friends I know in other countries have used it. And, you know, at a very basic level, the free basics thing does allow you access free of charge, right, to some things, you know, weather, news, jobs, job listings. But, you know, there are a few things that it's like with an asterisk, right? Ostensibly, you know, of course, you have to use a smartphone, and you know, a lot of my family, in parts of Kenya, and you know, and throughout Africa, don't actually need or use smartphones. Right? They're using flip phones, you know, relatively simple phones for text messaging and communication with one another. So, you know, right off the bat, you're going to have to, you know, eat a little bit more of a cost, and that's going to open you up to all these other things, right? You know, that Facebook would like for you to use, like its other services, its other goods, more advertising or surveillance from advertisers. So, but on the one hand, I think, like, you know, if we're being generous to it, yes, it does, you know, allow, it does allow some connection to the internet at limited bandwidths. And with some access to things that might help people.
It's actually how I keep up with that group chat on my phone, because I refuse to install the apps. I did once on an older phone, and it was I found it unpleasant. So if you just use – you can just pull it up in a browser.
A little 90s portal, right?
Yep, yeah. You can just pull it up in a browser, and it makes it really easy to just use the chat function and not look at the page at all. And it's been useful for me in that way. I know that's not the use case for it all over the world or here in America, but I just it's interesting that is out there and that it's usable. And you know, we had that incident where their servers went down. Was it like a year or two ago?
On my birthday, I remember that because I was like writing. I was writing right. Or stop to write about it, because I think like it was a really illustrative example, right? Maybe you don't put everything on one app,
right?
You know,
a single point of failure is maybe bad.
Yeah. You know, I think it's great in that you get to illustrate how like, hey, you know, you should be able to talk to people that you love across the world. Whether you should do it on one platform and one communications network is another question entirely. Right. I think there's an assumption that you scale things up and we'll just reap the benefits of the scale and reduced costs or additional, that we'll reap the benefits from like network effects. So this idea that like the more people you add, the cheaper it gets to add iterative people and do things for these iterative people. Right. But I mean, the reality is like, you know, you see something like Facebook's communications networks like WhatsApp and having a single point of failure, but also you have growing problem and issue with content moderation, with disinformation, that gets worse the larger you scale. And the solution is not you just hire more people, or outright the solution is not you just hire more people to sit down and manage the thing, right? So I think that's also part of it, where like these Facebook has also been a good argument against itself. The larger it has gotten, the harder it has been to manage, and the more clear that it's been, you need a decentralized or like pieces of these functions connected to one another, right?
Let's switch gears just a little bit. The thing that's in the headlines all the time is this metaverse, the virtual reality that he is pushing so hard. Why do you think, he had to know he was going to lose money. Why do you think that this is the thing that he has chosen to burn everything down to try to achieve?
I think, the way that people use the internet, there is no natural way to log on and use the internet. This money is about creating infrastructure, incentives, push, nudges, biases that compel you and everyone else to incorporate the metaverse into your lives. It's not that, maybe there is some world in which the metaverse is a good thing, but that's not really what's going on here. What's going on here is he has to subsidize the creation of a system where people can log on to the metaverse, where people would have a reason to log onto the metaverse, where there would be markets in the metaverse that would allow capital to flow into the metaverse, and that would incentivize more people to join, generate value that Facebook can, reap off the top. That's not going to be an easy task. And, it would take $100 billion, or more to kind of even, create the basic infrastructure in ensuring that the headsets are cheap enough, ensuring that.
Putting out a new, $1,500 headset is not going to draw in new users.
Yeah. Making your digital world look like IMVU is not going to draw in new users. Cloning games that you could have played on your PlayStation 1 is not going to bring in new users. But spending the tens of billions to create things that will bring in the users that then other money generators or capital allocators will be interested in to bring in more users is what's going to work. And so that's really what it is. I think that's also a big opportunity in that, the metaverse is not a natural thing. It will have to be constructed very actively and at a high cost. So there's a lot of time to resist it and to really think about it and to articulate alternatives to it and to just say no to it, because this is something that I think more so than other phases of privatization, the balkanization of the internet, will feel a lot more visceral, because you have to literally enter another medium that is a particularly disgusting and poorly made one by someone whom a lot of people in this world hate.
Yeah. Hey, we can't feed everybody. We know that it's really hot outside. It was 70 degrees here last night, by the way. Super sucks. Halloween night, 70 degrees. The things feel like they're getting worse, but you know what we can do? We can put you in a shipping container and we can put these goggles on your head and everyone can have a mansion in the metaverse, right?
Yeah. Everyone just needs to share that picture of the guy. And it's like two pictures, and one is him in the metaverse, jumping around or something like that. And then another is just dimly lit room. Nothing is in it. Bed is on the floor. No lights at all. That is, in one way or another, like what they're trying to do here.
Yeah.
It's not a good picture.
No. And you're right. Like, you are creating a whole new world for the purposes of monetizing everything possible in that world.
Yeah.
He's run out of oil to extract from us personally. So he's creating a new thing to try to figure out a way to hook us up to a machine to extract from us again.
Yeah. It is like the worst parts of many dystopias and cyberpunk futures imaginable. I mean, what is worse than not only being trapped in some simulacrum of reality where you can't even experience the taste and the smells and the touches, but one that feels like it was made 30 years ago and is full of some of the most annoying people you'll ever meet, you know, crypto zealots. I mean, there's nothing appealing about the genesis of this new world.
Natmiki in chat has a good question. The one of the things that's always fascinated me about this, like you said, it looks like it was made 30 years ago. Virtual reality is already out there, and is pretty fascinating and can be really fun. VR chat exists and is chaotic and weird and has that early internet energy. Natmiki asks, any sense of why Meta didn't buy VR chat? Meta's not been shy about buying its way into new social media formats.
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think part of it is, you know, what kind of world does Meta want to make? Because you're right. You know, there are lots of possibilities for virtual reality and augmented reality. You know, so what is the one that will be the most amicable to advertising and commodification and new revenue streams? And it's probably one that just sidesteps that entirely. I mean, I think part of it is people motivated by and adhering a little too closely to this microtransactions model that's been proliferating in games and has been around for a while, but it just feels like it hews a little bit too closely to this idea that the way to get you to pay for life is to get you to simulate life and then pay for everything in even smaller tranches of transactions in that fake life, as opposed to, you know, a variety of virtual reality experiences where some of them might simulate life and some of them might not. You know, some of them might just be overlays of text. Some of them might be images or, you know, sights or sounds that have nothing to do with the sort of daily experience that you have. But that in of itself is not monetizable. What is monetizable is figuring out a way to get people to move through VR space and AR space in a way that simulates real life. And then advertisers can immediately plop something in that will get them to go out and buy something else, or that will get them to do a transaction inside, you know.
Yeah, when you're buying, and this is psychoanalyzing him a bit, but when you're buying VR chat, you're buying a chaotic bundle. And like, do companies want to place advertisements outside of the bar that is full of Hank Hills and Garfields that are like coalescing into weird Junji Ito horrors, right? Do you want to go into the room where everyone's role playing as different beer bottles and try to figure out a way to sell those people a Toyota?
No, but I think you're right here. You know, I do think advertisers and people who are trying to do transactions are going to rely on curating spaces as much as possible. And there's a VR reality in which you don't do that. And there's one where you do. And the one where you do is the one where you make the money, off of these transactions and advertisements. And the one where you don't is where you have a much harder time rationalizing to someone to let you spend $100 billion on IMVU clone.
And I think this all, it's kind of funny. This is also a broader thing that I've been thinking about a lot because, censorship and like control of online spaces is like a big discussion piece, you know. We have the Intercept piece that came out yesterday about like the DHS trying to get involved. Like people on YouTube have a hard time figuring out what is, does, and doesn't fly there. And we talk about like these figures at the top, like Elon Musk is writing into Twitter on the back of like, I'm going to free everybody. Right. But I think the thing that we don't talk about enough or talk around is that the reason like YouTube is feeling more and more sanitized and you can't say and do certain things on around there is the same reason that like broadcast and cable television also got sanitized and why the internet became so popular. And it's because the money comes in, because the advertisers come in and the big money has control over what the rules are on those platforms. And they are more the force that is kind of stifling speech in these places, I think. What say you to that?
No, I think you're right. I think that, you know, when the logic of these platforms, when you're looking for capital outside to subsidize them, if you're looking subsidize in the sense that like they want even more money so they can be more profitable, so they can take bigger returns back to their investors and shareholders. Those forces are censorious in of themselves, right? Because, you know, like we've been talking about, they want to curate spaces and they want to sanitize spaces so that it's much easier to anticipate and operate off of an environment where you have nice little digestible bites and slices and demographic groups and identity groups that you're relying on. And if you're going to be doing that, then censoring or altering or limiting speech in one way or another so that advertisers feel safe and feel like they're getting a channel directly to who they want to. And also so that you can curate experiences and so you can curate commodities and so on and these transactions as well. Right. So I do think that once the money starts flowing in, it restructures everything, right? There's an insidious logic behind, you know, looking for outsized returns and excessive profits. That is antithetical to just like spontaneous expression and freedom of speech and creativity. Despite, I think, what some people might be led to believe, which is that like the more money you pour into something or the more money backing something, the more innovative it can be. When in reality, it's innovative in the sense that, you know, we're figuring out ways to preserve this formation and keep alternatives out.
Right. It creates a stasis because chaos is bad for business.
Right.
You know, it's harder to sell coffee, mm-hmm. you know, when you're in the middle of a disruption.
Exactly.
Something else I want to talk about that's in your piece that I thought was really fascinating. It is also kind of having an emperor has no clothes moment is this idea of techno-feudalism. Mm-hmm. What is techno-feudalism?
So I think, you know, techno-feudalism is this idea that we're not in capitalism anymore, that, you know, tech giants have figured out a way to disrupt the economic system. And as a result, you know, the most successful capitalists are these big tech firms that are not really concerned with taking excess profits and reinvesting them to expand, you know, their ability to produce at higher levels, which, you know, is a crux of capitalism, or they're not taking their profits and using it to increase the productivity of laborers and how much they can generate per hour, right? Instead, they're creating these surveillance platforms that are, you know, using workers in a precarious way for profit, and that is somehow distinct from capitalism, right? But I think that, you know, the techno-feudalist argument, there are two things to it. One is that there's some truth in this sense, in this picture of the world, right? Surveillance platforms and surveillance are imported to capitalism. And there feels like there's something special about these big tech firms because they're operating in the digital realm where we are spending our lives in a way that's different from how we might spend them in the workplace. And we have different relations to the platforms where we're spending them and to other people that we encounter on them. But I think it overestimates the role of surveillance here, in that, like, you know, surveillance has always been a core part of capitalism, right? I mean, one of the most successful, you know, aspects of capitalism is generating new assets for people to consume, or synthesizing new assets from pre-existing ones, and then using surveillance to make sure that people consume them at necessary rates, right? Whether this is in, you know, financial instruments, whether that's in loans of one variety or another, whether that's in, you know, consumer goods or products, there's always a need to institute surveillance and some form of social control to ensure that people are consuming at a certain level. The introduction of platforms complicates the picture a little bit, and the argument ends up becoming that, you know, these platforms are no longer like productive, you know, nodes in this economic system, but they are, you know, pillars of a new system that might be thought of as infrastructure for the larger economy and society at large, right? They are doing the telecommunication systems. They're the ones who are running the energy system. They're the ones who are running the computational system. They're the ones who are running the transportation system. You know, but when you dig deeper, you start to see a system that is, you know, more or less still capitalist. I mean, these big tech firms are still reinvesting tens of billions of dollars into research and development every single year, no matter what. Even if the product is, like we're talking about stasis, they are reinvesting the money to get, you know, to edge out more gains. But also, these big tech firms don't even own the stuff, right? They're renting. And that's also the other thing here, right? They're not rentiers who are extracting from us. They're renting, they're squatting on land, on cables, on data centers, on, you know, large tracts of land that are owned by real estate investment firms, funds. And so it ends up being that we're just looking at capitalism, but the digital side of it is just financialized assets, which are invested in to increase productive capacity, which is just capitalism, you know?
Right. And this idea of techno-feudalism becomes more of a myth that Silicon Valley perpetuates, that makes it seem like it has more power than it does.
Yeah, it's a useful one. I mean, it's like, you know, we are inevitable. We are the end destination of technological progress. And we have arrived at the end of history here. You know, we are just tinkering it out. You know, you guys don't have to worry about it. You know, we need to be big. We need to be a $1 trillion company. You just have to worry about, you know, what five or six apps you want to use that we offer in your life.
Yeah, a lovely Mintress Bold Bug future for all.
Yes. Everyone will have your butt or your bit, whatever the fuck it's called.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's pivot from there to, I think, one of the biggest techno-feudalist weirdos of them all, Elon Musk. He owns Twitter now. Are you fleeing?
No, I'm going to stay. I'm going to be in the pigsty with everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, I try to post less and less these days, but I'm scrolling. I'm scrolling every day and just getting upset.
You know, over the past few years, I've been happy about how much I've cut down the tweeting, but I still spend time on there. And I don't think that's going to change. You know, it's fun. I like having the ability to write a serious thread and then to shitpost the rest of the time. And also, the experience, I think, won't start to decay immediately. So that's also another incentive to not leave or anything like that. We'll see how bad it gets and how fast that happens, though.
Something I've been thinking about a lot is that for what I do, which is a lot of like geopolitics stuff and defense reporting, like everybody's on there. Like Zelensky's tweeting. The Russian Ministry of Defense is tweeting. You know, I wrote a story yesterday about the U.S. Army Fort Sill talking about posting a video of blasting a HIMARS using a HIMARS to blast candy at children. Like the powers of the world are talking to each other publicly there. And I don't know how that would change. I mean, it definitely could, as we, you know, if there's anything that you should take away from this conversation, audience, dear listener, it is that everything ends. On a long enough timeline, all this stuff will fade away, so it will be supplanted by something else. But in the near term, it is hard for me to imagine a world where Elon Musk chases these big players off the platform. Will he be able to extract $20 out of them for a blue check mark? That, I don't think, is going to work out the way he wants it to. Would you pay $20 a month for a blue check mark?
There's no amount of money I would pay for Twitter. I'm not even going to do Twitter blue. I mean, like I got Twitter by putting my name on a checklist. I mean, I got the check by putting it on a checklist.
Right.
And if I lose it, so be it. You know, it doesn't matter that much. And I think that it is funny. I'm very curious also how he rolls it out. He's been waffling. He's like tweeting at everyone who tweets about it. And the
picking issue. A fight with Stephen King today.
Yeah, a little silly there. and there's a real issue. He has to raise enough money to pay down the billion dollar debt interest that, you know, comes out from all the debt financing. But my God, making the blue checks pay $20 a month is
the math is it's something. There's like 400,000 blue checks. If you get $20 a month from them, that is, if you get all of them to pay kick in $20 a month, which they're not all going to do, it's 8 million, right? Is that going to even put a dent in anything?
No.
Maybe this whole website is a bad business model and always has been.
Maybe some things shouldn't be businesses and should just be offered for free and in the public interest. You know, not saying Twitter as it is right now is that, but there is a case to be made that, hey, you know, maybe you shouldn't turn Twitter into a business. Maybe one of the reasons why Facebook sucks so fucking much is because it keeps getting turned into or pushed towards lines of inquiry for business models, right? That maybe we should look at public communication networks and this town square he keeps talking about he wants so much.
This leads to a great another comment from the Twitch. Namiki says, I feel in recent years that users are on a platform, Discord, for example, and will be there until it becomes popular enough that advertisers and other stakeholders make it intolerable and then we'll move on. Conceiving of ourselves as digital nomads who will move from platform to platform to evade the worst effects of capitalism. I mean, yes, right? Like Discord is now bothering me every time I log on to give them $3 a month to use like more avatars. And I'm like, I don't like this.
Yeah.
This is how the fever starts.
You know, I think, it's really unfortunate in that, you know, the various internets we have are just, you know, suffering or get, you know, infected with the rot, with the advertiser rot and the money rot at different speeds, but eventually it comes for everybody. And figuring out how to hold that back is really going to be something that would, I think, be a huge improvement, you know, freeing all of these platforms from money logic and market logic and focusing on like what would actually be enjoyable, you know, what would actually be pleasurable, what would be a good way to connect with people. Instead of like, how can we structure it so that you hear as much as possible so I can generate advertiser revenue from you?
I think that's a really great note to end on. Edward, where can people follow you on Twitter?
Big Black Jacobin at Twitter.
He is a great follow. Lots of serious threads and also pretty amazing shit posts. If you like Cyber, please follow us on YouTube at youtube.com/motherboard or at Twitch at twitch.tv/motherboardTV. We are broadcasting live. You can notice the IKEA shelves in the background. If you're listening to the podcast, there are IKEA shelves in the background. There may be an actual set here. Things may be upgraded soon. It may look better. I promise. It's all happening. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will be back a little bit later this week with another discussion. I think we're going to talk about Ticketmaster. All right. See y'all next time.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.